Thank you, Brother Barry. Good morning, brothers and sisters. Brother Henry thought I'd forgotten this yesterday, but it was there hiding under the jacket all the time. A special word of thank you to Brother Craig this morning. Where's Brother Craig? Where is he? There he is. No, he's there, and there will be a day of reckoning, my brother.
Your head is blurred now.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I noticed. This is supposed to be out of focus, and he got it crystal clear. I mean, he unblurred the blur. Yeah, well, I guess the head of the serpent or something. Yeah, I'm focusing on the truth in the home.
We start with the key verse and a little bit of revision this morning,
just to sort of set the ground of where we're going. Once again, no study in this. It's not a study, it's just a discussion, this series of talks. Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labour in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. Famous words, and their truth is sometimes lost on us because they are so famous. Unless the Lord builds the house, it is the Lord's house. When it's our house, we tend to think of our houses as our houses and our families as our families and so on. And the point that we need to constantly be reminded of, it's a simple point, and I know that I don't need to stress it, is that these things belong to the Lord. They are of the Lord and they must be given back to Him. The question arises, why has He put us in families? Why do we live, you know, there's lots of animals around, we're part of the animal kingdom, I suppose. Why are we in families? That's the question. Why families? Well, to propagate the species? Well, yeah, I guess. To provide each individual with, a secure social environment and happiness. Yes, that too. As a safe haven for the very young and for the very old. Yeah, all of that. But the answer of the Word of God is rather interesting. In Malachi chapter 2, he says, has not the one God made and sustained for us the spirit of life? And what does he desire? So he's given us life, you see? And what does he want? It's interesting, isn't it, that Brother John has this theme. He talked about that which we give to God and which we then give back to him. You know, he started the week in that way. And then this morning he raised the flip side of that, that which God gives and we give back. Well, now he has given to us the spirit of life. And what does he desire in exchange? The answer is two words, godly offspring. And we read about it in that psalm, that introductory psalm. And this is the objective of our being set in families and our being set in our homes. And consequently, when we address this question of focusing on the truth in the home, then it is this which we have. Godly offspring is kind of the heading over the door that we want to keep in mind as we go along. And notice the corollary which Malachi adds to this. It's a kind of a word of, so take heed to yourselves, get focused, and let none be faithless to the wife of his youth. And of course that includes the question of fidelity, which these days is a very serious issue and is by no means confined just to brethren, although it is rather interesting that Malachi here addresses the brethren. In this, he says, take heed to yourselves and let none be faithless to the wife of his youth. But it involves a lot more than the question of fidelity. It involves the whole idea of the partnership which exists between a husband and a wife, the role that the husband has, particularly because the wife is so vulnerable, to guide and to cherish and to provide all those things which are necessary. And this question of keeping faith is, it seems to me, a very easy matter to overlook. And we can even have marriages and homes which kind of function in a sort of a way, and we attend the meetings and we're involved in the ecclesia, and still not quite rise to that extent of faith which I think is implied in this context here. A rather eloquent verse, that, but one which we don't have time to do very much more with than just simply point out, because this is just by way of revision, if you understand. The husband's principal role, then, and basically what we have here is a partnership, and we're going to just look at these roles which each partner has to undertake. he acts towards his wife as Christ acts towards the Ecclesia. At least that is what he's intended to do, and that is his aspiration. Now this is a good exercise, because you see what it means is he has to sit down, he has to actually work out exactly what it is that Christ has done for the Ecclesia. I mean, obviously you can't follow the pattern unless you see the pattern, and so the husband has a responsibility particularly to look at that which the Lord has done for the Ecclesia, and having identified that and sort of brought it into focus, he then has to do his best to actually do that, apply it in a kind of a way towards his wife. And of course his wife, if she is a good wife, will respond in such a way as to give him the opportunity to do that. I mean, you can imagine the kind of scenario where the husband's trying very hard to act this way and the wife won't allow it to happen. So this is a partnership, and the husband can't succeed in this clearly without the wife's cooperation, and the same will be true when we look at her role. The key text is, of course, from Ephesians chapter 5. The husband's the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church, which is his body, and is himself its saviour. And that is a tremendous attitude which brethren have to take towards their wives, and there are lots of supporting texts to go with that notion. Quick revision, remember, and we're moving on. The wife's principal role is to act toward her husband as the Ecclesia should act toward Christ. And you'll notice that this picks up again that notion that I put before, that there's a partnership in this, that they need to work together on that. She needs to think of ways of helping her husband develop in his Christ-likeness. And sisters sometimes complain, I mean, I've heard sisters complain, they don't get the opportunity to get up here and speak and so on. Frankly, for me, I would give it to the sisters very, very happily, because it is, you know, a job which we have to do. But the sisters have, in some respects, a far more challenging task than that, and that is to allow themselves to be, to act in such a way as to develop their husbands mutually with themselves. And it's a tremendous concept, and one which, of course, I'm not actually qualified to talk about. I mean, it's a concept which escapes my mind, quite frankly. I can think about it in principle, but how to do it, that's the big question. And I suppose what we're going to do is we're going to discuss ways and means of doing this without actually addressing that question. We're going to have it in the back of our minds. That's the idea. The key text. Oh, I called the husband the chairman of the board before, and the wife the chief executive officer. Now, I don't know much about corporate structure, but it seems to me that that's a fairly good way of describing it. The chairman of the board has a kind of a supervisory role in a kind of a way, but the chief executive officer is the person who sees that things are done. And that really is the wife's role, as it seems to me. So the key text is, wives, be subject to your husbands as to the Lord. It's a very serious issue, that, you see, because it is the wife's responsibility to make the home run and this relationship that we're talking about. So wives, be subject to your husbands as to the Lord. That's a special kind of subjection. It's not a sort of grovelling subjection at all. Rather, you see, the Lord develops us all, and it's an aspiring thing, something which aspires to higher things. There's some exalted ideas in this, aren't there? As the church is subject to Christ, so let wives also be subject in everything to their husbands. And you know that as the Lord develops in the Ecclesia, those principles and those methods of modes of thinking which are pleasing to him, so we have in a good marriage. Lots of supporting texts too. Now, of course, as Coral pointed out to me very quickly when I was developing this series, she said there's a lot of brothers and sisters who are not married, and not seven families, and so momentarily at least we're going to just address their position. There are single brethren, those who perhaps would prefer to be married, brothers and sisters. It is a bit of a problem finding clip art, but there you go. The point is, married or single, we're all part of God's family, which is the Ecclesia. This is something which the world can't give and doesn't have to give. You see, we are all set in families.
whether we're married or single. And while it is not perhaps as easy, you don't have the immediate family, still there is the family of God. And so single brothers and sisters ought to think of the ecclesia as their family and take to themselves the roles which they would have if they were in a literal family. And the flip side to that is that the ecclesia ought to consider the needs of the single, those whom God has not placed in their own family, and provide the means by which each of those can express themselves and find a role to fulfill, you know, a fulfilling role. Now, I have to say that in our meeting, we've been a little disastrous in this once or twice. We have single brothers, and mostly sisters, who feel left out. They say, we don't have a family, you know. Everything is done in families, and we come along and we don't really belong here. And we have to find ways and means of addressing that problem because their needs are as great as anybody else's, perhaps more so in some respects. So single brethren should take the role of a father for the family of God, and single sisters the corresponding role of a mother to the families. I thought a little bit about this question of what families are to do. Remember the godly seed that Malachi spoke about. Seems to me that there are three things which parents need to try and achieve as they bring up their families. Three things which need to be addressed, and they are set out in order here. The first is that we should instill in our children the facts of a life in the Spirit. The facts. So you have to have a factual basis. And we do that by reading the Bible or Bible stories to the children. And by talking about what the Bible says. And the idea is, at the first level, is that they should understand the facts about the Bible and what the Bible teaches. The second is, we need to teach the attitudes which are appropriate to a spiritual life. Now, you can't get the attitudes without an understanding of the academic basis of it. So the facts come first. And of course you do these things all in parallel in a sense, and you develop them, but there are really, it seems to me, three distinct processes involved in this. The second part of it then is to teach the attitudes which are consistent with a spiritual life, a life of the Spirit. Okay, and we do that by discussion, by correction, by providing the discipline which is needed, but mostly we do it by example. And children absorb things just by osmosis, really. I mean, it just sort of soaks in through their skins to some extent, that's for good or for ill, as a matter of fact, and consequently it's very important for us to live our lives in the way that we would have our children turn out, and if we take liberties of one sort or another, then we shouldn't be surprised if our children take liberties also, because after all that's what we've shown them how to do, what to do. And that is a real very great a challenge to us. And the third thing is, out of attitudes come actions. And I suppose I got immediately onto the actions, but if you think about it, what you do is generated out of the way you're thinking, and your attitude generates or governs the way you're thinking. So you see the way in which this simple development works. Now, I personally have a very simple mind, as you've noticed, and I like to have a simple listing like that. You know, it helps to actually just clarify what exactly is going on. And you can identify what you're doing at any given time. You find yourself doing these things if you're dealing with the children. Teach actions and habits, finally, that are appropriate to a spiritual life. And we do that by discussion and by example. It's an extension of the second one. These are all part of the same process, aren't they? And by expecting that the children will attend all appropriate ecclesial functions. It was never a matter of discussion in our household, and although we have not been notably successful in raising our children, we have an adopted son who has given us more grief than I really care to discuss, and a daughter who came to the truth and left the truth through a disastrous marriage. And has given us a grief that I can't even begin to describe. We've not been notably successful in that which we're discussing. At least we're able to identify with these things. We have really done our conscientious best to do these things, and I don't think that anything more can be expected of parents.
throughout all of this, we have expected that our children, if they're living at home, are going to attend what's going on at the meeting. And we've done our very best to influence the meeting to make the activities which the children are sharing in palatable to them and understandable to them, and consistent with their needs. And of course, if you're going to expect the kids to go to the meetings, then you've got to go along too. I've got an interesting sort of story there. I went into our meeting one Sunday morning, and a little girl, I'm actually not very good with young children, but I try to come down to the level of the kids, perhaps rise to the level of the kids. I squat down and talk to the little kids and a little bit, try to, and a little girl came up to me, and a delightful little girl, and I talked to her, and how are you this morning? And she said, I'm okay, but I wish I was daddy today. I said, why is that? And she said, well, he's not feeling very well today. I said, well, you want to be like dad and feel not well? And she said, yeah, but he could stay home from the meeting and watch TV. So, out of the mouths of babes and sucklings, And some kinds of attitudes come through from time to time. It's kind of interesting. So we need to be supportive in a practical kind of way. Sort of get out there and get with them. Of course, the children have responsibilities as well. Before I get to the children, let's just take cast our minds without looking in detail at some examples of good parents in the scriptures. Abraham. I know Abraham. He will teach his household, after him. Remember that? And the faithful Israelite in Deuteronomy 11. Talk about these things in the way, and whenever you rise up and whether you sit down, and so on, Deuteronomy 11. David prayed for Solomon, do you remember, in 1 Chronicles chapter 29. Hezekiah, interesting Hezekiah. There's just this little record in Isaiah chapter 38 where he talks about that which we just read about in the Psalm, about passing on the heritage to the children and so on. Okay, that was Hezekiah. Lois and Eunice, remember the recommendation of Timothy, his heritage which had been passed to him by his mother and his grandmother. Interesting that, not his father and grandfather, but his mother and his grandmother, and we may come back to that. And lots of other relevant texts. Now, there's a couple of things I'd like to say about this, and that is in relation to the question of the successfulness or otherwise of that which we undertake. I want to ask you a question. How many of you know that Abraham was a good parent? He was concerned about his family. He was concerned with futurity. That's one of the definitions of a good Christadelphian. He's concerned about the future. And Abraham was, and it was because of that he was chosen. And the promises were made to him, and so on. And he was a good father. Do you know how many sons he had? Now, how many of them came to the truth? One of the points that I'm trying to take out of that is that a parent, and I'm not just trying to rationalise our grief, I'd just like that the brotherhood should be just a little aware of the incredible grief that it is to parents who are devoted, for whom the truth is their life, when they see that despite the everything that they can do, it just doesn't work. And the children go their own way. I mean, we know, we console ourselves, who knows what will happen in the future. But the point is that there is a point at which the children take responsibility for themselves. And there isn't anything you can do about it. You simply have to learn to accept it. And it can be a very difficult matter. But you know the grief that Abraham felt over Ishmael. And yet God had a view of him that just didn't work, did it? Hezekiah. Do you ever see a better man than Hezekiah walking around? I'm using this in a relative term, of course, the Lord Jesus Christ, but generally speaking, on the face of the earth, you see a better person than Hezekiah walking around? And do you remember who his son was? And can you begin to imagine the grief that Hezekiah might have felt over that? Had he lived to see it? And so what I'm saying is there's a need to for the ecclesia to be very much sensitive and aware of this kind of thing, and to understand that sometimes the Lord tests us in ways that that he only knows best. Right? There's more could be said about that.
The fact of the matter is it requires cooperation with the children. So the children have a role to play as well. And it goes like this.
They have to learn to love and respect their parents
so as to learn to love the Lord and receive his blessing.
Now once again, this is a cooperative venture, something which the children have to, they have to do it. They have to be taught how to do it, and you do it by example, but it's a matter of cooperation. They both need to work at it together. And so we need to set up our homes in such a way that that is possible. And this can be a bit of a challenge. It's a full-time job. It really is. Key verse, honour your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land which the Lord your God gives you. Of course, that's from Exodus chapter 20. Lots of other key verses which could be quoted as well. And there are those supporting texts. Well, so much for the theory of it. That's what we're trying to achieve, isn't it? Now, let's discuss, and if I pull this off too quickly, forgive me, come and see it later if you want, they'll be here. Let's now discuss the practical reality of it. There are the blurring factors, and I guess we've all been subject to these. When we were young, we had no money at all. Our home was a place where we came to eat and sleep and wash and dress and rush out so that we could make more money to pay for the house where all of this happened, I suppose. When we first married, memories are dim, it all happened in a blur. And as children arrived, the home continued to be a place with the same place, with the addition of sleep interrupted nights and changing nappies and a wife with an altered set of priorities, less money, more pressure to fence the house, pave the, you know, put in the paths and paint the house and fix the car. And when you have no money in New Zealand, you do these things yourself. And so sandwiched in there somewhere, it was also the place where Bible studies were done, classes were prepared, classes were hosted, guests were entertained, young brethren and sisters were boarded. We had a constant stream of people staying with us. Major construction projects were undertaken. The odd motor caravan and a bus and a whole bunch of other things which I seem to manage somehow or other to get involved in. And as the children grew, their education became a pressing need, not just reading, writing and arithmetic, but their education in the word. And particularly for our children, their education in the way of the life demanded by the word of God became a place of too frequent conflict. I'm reading my notes here, between strong-willed youngsters and the need to live according to God's ways. Now, I guess that's pretty typical, really. I mean, for most of us, there are these blurring factors. For those who can't read that, on the one side, the husband is dragging the load and has in mind the mortgage, the car repayments, the house and garden maintenance, staying up to date at work. These days, it's quite a pressure, you see. You've got to keep up to date with the change of technology and stuff. Family responsibilities, bills, taxes, insurance, ecclesial duties, and I've put leisure down there, and some people think that leisure is a relief from the load, but let me tell you that the way that New Zealanders go about leisure, it's a burden, especially if it involves golf, or rugby, or bowls, for that matter. And on the other side of the coin, there's the wife standing there with the rolling pin, to meet him. I'm sure that he's going to meet it, but the rolling pin, yeah, but she's just holding the rolling pin. I'm sure she's just rolling, basically. She's not going to lay it about him. Clothing and sewing, shopping and cooking, washing and cleaning, home and garden, care of the children and the elderly. And that's some of the things which I thought of. Perhaps I should have consulted Coral, and her list would have been three times as long as mine. Those are the things which get into us, you know, and it seems to me that in all of this, as I suggested before, the wife is chief executive officer. She does most of the work. Again, this may not be the way you organise your family. It just turns out to be the way that we organised ours, and it possibly is typical. Where I found myself was in other places, generally speaking. And I only have dim memories of the children growing up. Actually, I was rather moved this morning to notice Matthew with the video camera and videoing his little one. And I thought, there is a moment, just a moment in time, when he has that awareness and that contact and that rapport, Matthew and Petru. And that moment is going to pass so quickly. And if he can keep that tape, he will treasure it. I know, they both will treasure it. Because it just goes so... You don't know where it goes. I look back, I don't know where it's gone. It's a blur. I don't remember the details. I remember the little isolated incidents. We look at the snapshots and we wonder and we find it hard to believe that they were little like that and so sweet, and now look what they are. Sometimes. Where was I? I was out at work. I was fixing the house. I was studying to keep up to date. I was working on some project in the backyard, and sometimes I would go outside and I'd work all day. I'm building a bus, and I come in and I sit down and dinner. I'd been there all day, and I say to Coral, do you know, I cut and I fitted, welded and I ground off and I painted 4 pieces of steel in that bus today. 4 pieces of steel, it was a day's work. So, well, that's unbelievable. Well, you know, there's thousands of pieces of steel in a bus. So you can spend a lot of time on stuff like that. It was for the right reason. I mean, basically, it wasn't for our personal use, it was for ecclesial work, and we got a lot of use out of it. You know, but all the same, there is this investment that you have to make, and you have to make these kinds of decisions. There's a balancing act that has to go on here. How much of your time and your effort do you put into ecclesial things, and how much into your own private family and so on? I don't know that we made the right judgments. I can't say. The only thing is, I suppose that I did what my personality and nature did, and we just find a way. And for everybody, the balance is different. And there isn't a single answer to this that is satisfactory for everybody. You know. And brother, I remember a brother coming around, and he watched me in this, and it was just a chassis set up on blocks and bits of steel sticking up. And he looked at it, and he scratched his head, and he said, what on earth are you doing? And I told him, and he said, why don't you just go and buy one? Well, there's a simple answer to that. There wasn't any money. Okay? So you do what you have to do. You do what you choose to do, and sometimes the choices are right and sometimes they're not. I can't say whether it was right or wrong for Bill Bass. I know that the Ecclesia got a lot of benefit out of it. I hope that it didn't impinge too badly on their family. But who can tell? You can't answer a lot of these questions. It's just the way it happened. Buried in the study or away speaking somewhere. So what happens is that the actual work of running the home has been Coral's work. You know, she's always at home, reliably at home. We'll talk about that in a minute. She has time to devote to the children. She not only has the time, but she has the temperament. And she does it. And she has a stock of Bible songs, books, puzzles and stories. Whenever we go to a different town, she says, where's the Bible shop? And she goes there and she fishes around, not for heavy reference books. I look along and see if there's anything that I like, and I like a lot of it, but it's too expensive, so I leave it there. But she comes out with a lot of little books for the kids, you see, and she still does that. Constantly is speaking about the Bible to the children, and now she's carrying on the work with the grandchildren. And never ever quit. In fact, what I said when our children got to the stage where they were leaving home, I said, good, now we can go through the house and chuck out all this junk, you know, the doll's house and the toys and that sort of thing. And now grandchildren come in, and the first thing, not only grandchildren, but children in the ecclesia, they come into our house and they make a beeline for the corner bedroom because they know where all the toys are. Before long, they're scattered all over the house. So she carries that work on. The point that I would make about all of this is that there is a clear dichotomy. There is a clear cutting off of the lines of responsibility in our family. It may not suit you, but it's a way it's worked out in our family. I knew exactly what I was responsible for. Exactly. I mean, I mow the lawns, which is a matter of some grief to Coral too, for another reason, because sometimes I'm not very discreet with the lawn mower. it wanders. And one of her things is she every time she goes to town, she comes back with a little plant in a pot, you see. And she's done that for years. Well, you can imagine we live in a jungle now, because these little plants have grown up, and the lawnmower, as I say, wanders from time to time. It's a matter of some grief to calm. I don't do a lot else around that sort of area. She's interested in gardening. Her ideas of gardening and mine are different, and consequently, well, I don't mind her, her way of doing it. That's fine, because that means I don't have to do it. But the thing is, there is a clear division, and we are agreed about it. And the nice thing about it is that this division of the work has increased the total input to the truth. When Coral met me, she was saving to go on a world trip, to go travelling. She wanted to travel. She met me, and that was the end of that. And we put the money that she'd accumulated into our home and that sort of thing and so on. It was very important because that, she had money and I didn't have. And as a result of that, and this division of labour, I spend a lot of time in the study. And as a result of that, she's done more travelling than she ever would have. And it's been a fantastic blessing, really. And really, it's the work that she has done. Because I didn't have to be concerned about a lot of the things. She worked willingly, long and hard, you know, and it's a choice that she made. Now, I'm not saying that everybody has to do it the way we've done it, but it has worked out. Very certainly, that is one area where it has worked out for the best. And looking back, we would do it again the same way. There are lots of things we're not sure we would do again the same way, but that one, we would. And the sitting down and working out exactly where our strengths were and exploiting those strengths for the sake of the truth, mutually, and agreeing to do that, there's never been any tension over that. And it's not been imposed, it's been a matter of agreement. And it wasn't agreement, actually, that needed to be hammered out at a conference table, either. It was something which we simply converged towards, and we agreed about, and cooperated and supported each other in, and it has been tremendously fruitful, both for ourselves, because we both felt fulfilled in our ways, if you can get any fulfilment in this life, but for the truth, and for our great family. It's tremendous. So the division of work is important. Need to work out what that is. Now, I'm going to go on a little bit to be a bit more specific, but before I do that, I'd like to say that I'm going to express my opinions. And I'd just like to make the point that different views are allowable. This has got nothing to do with the subject there, just an example from the Lord Jesus Christ. You know, when the discussion came up about divorce and so on, I don't want to discuss it as a divorce, but just using this as an illustration. The disciples said to Jesus, if this is the case of a man with his wife, he'd better not to marry. You know, it's what, as a result of what the Lord had said to them. And Jesus' answer to them is rather interesting, and it's something which I think we need to bring into our broader councils, not just in our homes, but also in our ecclesias. You know, not all men can receive this saying, but only those to whom it is given. You know, sometimes in our clear life we take the standards of perfection, the counsels of perfection, and we grind them into the face of brethren who are not as strong as we are, or perhaps have stronger impulses than we have, and we apply our abilities to them, and we do this in a rather unkind fashion sometimes. And the Lord didn't do that. He said, not all men can receive the saying, and there are lots of sayings which not all men can receive. Now, it's perfectly true that he's talking about a specific issue here. What I'm suggesting to you is that there are many such issues, and we ought to be a little careful about how we apply it. So all I'm doing here is just raising that to say, look, I'm going to give you a few suggestions based largely on our experience, because I can't really talk about anybody else's. I'm sorry to keep presenting our point of view. But just understand that different views are possible and perfectly acceptable. The key to the whole thing of focus on the truth at home, it seems to me, is that the wife is at home. And I've listed a few things here which seem to me to flow from that. If a wife is at home, she can give the children the undivided attention which they need. That's the first thing. She can keep the home so that both the husband and wife are able to spend their evenings on work for the truth. That has certainly worked out. We've seen both of those points there. I'm not elaborating very much on them, although there's a good deal that could be said and some quite interesting stories. A wife, if she stays at home, can stay somewhat focused on the truth. And when the children come home from school, having been immersed in a system, we're not going to talk about young people, but the school system, at least in our country, is a very negative thing, and I'm putting that by mildly. And so if the wife is at home and the children come home from that environment, then she can redirect them. And when the husband comes home and he's had a frustrating day or whatever, he's been immersed in the things of the world, then the wife at home, if she does it the right way, she can bring a calm and a spiritual flavour to this homecoming, which I'm sure she would have great difficulty doing if she were to sort of come in as the husband arrived home, you know, and the kids have been home watching television since they came home from school, you know, you give them a key or something like that. I mean, it's not a satisfactory arrangement. I know that it's inevitable sometimes these days, and I know that there are yes buts that can be said to everything that I'm saying here, but I'm giving you what I regard as counsels of perfection without, I hope, being dogmatic about it. She should be able to make some time for Bible reading and study, and I know that Coral does this, she won't mind my saying so. She has made it a rule after I had gone off to work, she would then spread out some books on the lounge, on the table in the dining room, and she would spend a couple of hours, an hour and a half to 2 hours every morning virtually, doing her readings carefully and you know, checking up the Strong's Concordance and that sort of thing, writing notes in the margin of the Bible, and her own private Bible study. She didn't depend upon me. She had made her own faith, and this, I think, is very important for all sisters. It's important to share with your husband, but it's also important to make your own relationship with the Lord, in not independently of your husband, but in fact be able to share with him some of the things which you find, because most husbands are only too pleased to pick up those gems themselves. And so that's important, it seems. She should be able to make some time for Bible reading, study and prayer. It's a question of routines and getting that sorted out. She may be able to help other families if she's at home by looking after children or by cooking for the sick or elderly and so on. And certainly that's something which has been a feature in our meeting. She may be able to visit or phone those who need support. And there's an elderly sister in our meeting who's crippled by arthritis and so on, lives in a rest home. But her mind is as sharp as a tack, and she feels as though she's in a kind of prison because she can't move. So Coral has spent hours on the telephone, pick up the phone and phone her. And when she's running out of things to say, she will read her something, because the sister has also lost her sight. She can't read very well, so she'll read a work of the truth and serialise it, you know, and the sister would really get to look forward to it. She can't do that if she goes to work, and this is a tremendously important, valuable work which is done. And Coral, I keep mentioning Coral, she's not the only one who does that sort of thing. And so this is something that can be done. May have time to do some proclamation work, and Coral and another sister, I don't think the sister by herself should want to do too much of this, but if they can get together in groups, go and post bills, knock on doors and so on, and I know that our Sunday school was once very small and it grew because of this effort of going knocking on doors and that sort of thing. So there is all sorts of activity. Maybe able to practice the piano for meetings or undertake some other helpful task, such as bringing flowers each Sunday and so on. I think Cora will probably forgive me for saying that she's not a natural pianist. She hasn't, but what she has done is to persevere at that. She spent thousands of hours at it, practicing, because we had no organist in the ecclesia. And she worked at it and worked at it and worked at it, and still does, just to do the best that she can. And this has been a real labour of love for her, and I know something of a burden from time to time, as she's expressed it. So there are some of the things that a wife can do if she's at home. And then the question is, why go to work then
if the desirable situation is to be at home,
why would we go to work? Well, we know that there are realities in the situation today. Economics, plain old-fashioned economics, are the reason why a lot of sisters go to work. Although I have to say that sometimes we try for a lifestyle which requires the wife to go to work, where we could get by with a lifestyle which is a little less. And I think what has to happen in each case is that each family must carefully search the validity of its case. And that's a matter of personal conscience. And if it's a matter of personal conscience, that means we've got to get on with it ourselves and do it. That's one side of it. The flip side of that is it's nobody else's business. And I think that the ecclesia should let the brethren alone. See, there are ecclesias around the world who put pressure on the young people and say, well, the wife goes home, and that's where she stays. Now, that may be appropriate for Coral and me. It may be appropriate for a lot of people. But it isn't a rule that can be applied, and it should be applied. It's something which people have to work out for themselves, as it seems to me. Having said all of that, you notice if you look at the scriptures that women had usually had to go out to work anyway. And if you look at some of the examples that are there, Rachel was working, Lydia was a worker, Moses' sisters-in-law all worked, Ruth was a worker. And if you just think about it, they had to take a part in the, you know, producing the goods for the family. So I think we've got to be a little bit careful about that, because in the cases that I've cited up there, going to work didn't interfere with their spirituality. So it is possible to do it, but in my opinion, it's probably better if they don't do it. A few women didn't have to work, and they were usually wealthy women, like the Shunammite woman that looked after Elisha, for example. And notice there that even she used the opportunities that had been given to her in the service of the truth, and that's the important thing.
That's one reason why women go to work. Another one is for intellectual stimulation and fulfillment. Stimulation comes in a couple of ways. One is intellectual stimulation, or intellectual fulfillment. The other one is social fulfillment, social stimulation. These are quite different things, and you may have a different attitude to them. Intellectual stimulation and fulfillment. We have very highly educated young sisters who find it very difficult to stay at home with children. You know, they say that if I have one more screaming brat, I'm going to go bananas, you know. And they feel that they need to go out and, you know, lift their minds and so on. Well, and the other thing that is, even in some ecclesias you find this, I'm thinking of one particular sister now, she's actually worked her way through this now, I'm very pleased to say, resenting her husband's freedom to pursue a career. Saying, why should he get to have a career and I stay home and look after the kids? So, you know, I want to go out and I want to fulfill myself too, you see. Now, you know, if the husband attacks his career as his thing and this is the main focus of his life, then I think she's got a point. If, on the other hand, the husband takes an attitude towards his job, such as I was trying to suggest yesterday, namely that it's a means to an end, an adjunct to life, in which he's making a contribution to the mutual business of the family, then she will understand that, and she won't resent the fact that he is doing that and she has to do this. There will be a balance in these things and an understanding, you see what I mean. So once again, it comes down to this, the nature of the relationship and exactly what it is that they have agreed to do and what they expect to get out of their relationship, and as an extension of that, what they expect to put into it. So there, if his career is his main goal, then she may have a point. The other thing is a little bit more subtle social stimulation, to go out to work just because you've got to have people around you, you know, maybe a bit more of a dangerous position and one that needs to be looked at. The main thing is, as I said before, we are free to decide about these issues. There's no hard and fast rules, it seems to me. The question we ought to ask ourselves, the needs that we feel, can they be met in the Lord's service? And I think that they can. I think it is possible, if you have an ecclesia that's somewhat suitable to this, I think it's possible to find these needs being met. And finally, there was a sister that I asked
why she went to work.
Because, you know, a lot of the stuff I actually asked people, and she said, you know my situation at home. She said, it just gets me down. In that case, she had a husband who was less than helpful. He is, in the truth, but he's by no means helpful to her. And she just lives in what is all but an intolerable situation. And so she takes respite by going to work. She has she's just taken a job as a cook in a rest home, you know, doing that sort of work. She wasn't looking for fulfillment, intellectual fulfillment or something like that. Just a moment of sanity out of it, you know, because she spent a lifetime wrestling with the problem. And she finds that by just withdrawing herself from that just for the time, and then going, I never thought of that. I wouldn't have thought of that as a possible or legitimate reason. But having listened to that sister and knowing something of the situation, I understand. So realistically, there are some problems to which there just simply is no answer this side of the kingdom. I mean, and we've all talked to her husband. We've spent time and we try to support them and give him a more positive attitude. But realistically, it isn't going to happen. And so she's just doing what she has to do to cope with that, and that's fair enough. The problem is, of course, a very great caution, if the problem has to do with the home, the system, we have to be very careful not to let the world's relative attractions take over. And this sister is a very strong sister, and she knows, you know, what's involved in it. So that's fine. Stuffed tiger is a companion, constant companion, and this stuffed tiger is a stuffed tiger when there's anybody else around, but he's a real living person with a personality when there's nobody else around, you see. So Calvin and Hobbes. Hobbes is a tiger and Calvin is the boy. And on this question of television, you see, there are a number of things that I would say about television. The first is that it can grab you, and here's a little Calvin and Hobbes. I wrote to the publisher and I said, please, may I, with respect, I photocopy these and show them at conferences, and they and we're done with sympathy, and I will be advancing Mr. Waterson's points, you know, I'm not, you know, this is going to be positive, it's going to be publicity for you. And they said, no, we don't need publicity, you may not use these as OHPs. So having told me that I'm not allowed to do it, the best I can do is describe it to you. Here's Calvin talking to Hobbes. You see, this is not breaking the copyright, I hope. I just read this great science fiction story, says Calvin to Hobbes. It's about how machines take control of humans and turn them into zombie slaves. Hobbes picks up the book and he looks through it and he says, so instead of us controlling machines, they control us, huh? Pretty scary stuff, isn't it? And then Calvin looks at his watch. Hey, he said, what time is it? My TV show's on. You know, so the machine takes control, you see. And there's some pretty insightful stuff here. Here's another one, you see. The proposition here is that TV actually educates us to have a short attention span. I'd love to talk a bit about what I've seen in the schoolroom about the attention span and the level of achievement of children in the last 28 years. I have stood in the same room teaching the same class of kids in the same school, and I've watched this parade. It's fascinating to be able to see this, and I'm telling you, there has been a steep drop in the achievement, and it has exactly coincided with the arrival of TV in New Zealand, notably American TV. Short attention span, that's the key to it. Here's Calvin and Hobbes sitting in front of the TV. I think the short attention span of TV is great. As far as I'm concerned, if anything's so complicated that you can't explain it in 10 seconds, it's probably not worth knowing anyway. My time is valuable. I can't go thinking about one subject for minutes on end. I'm a busy man. Yes, is Hobbes. He's been sitting here for 3 hours at 6 thoughts per minute. So, yeah, that's a serious problem. You see, you want to come to the truth? You've got to work at it. This is something where you sit quietly at the feet of the master and you learn over a period. Now, children have to be taught that skill. And they are not going to learn it from TV, and they're not going to get it from school either. So this is something which we need to pay attention to. The third one is these TV programs sure are rotten. TV is rubbish, and we all know it's rubbish, but we sit there and we watch it. Here's Calvin again speaking to Hobbes. These TV programs sure are rotten, he says. There isn't an ounce of imagination in the whole bunch. What booge, he says. Who do they think is stupid enough to sit and watch this trash? Hobbes walks away and he says, you. Calvin replies, if there's anything better to watch, I'd watch that. That's true. That's true. It contains far too much violence. Calvin and Hobbes again. Hobbes comes in with the newspaper and he says to Calvin, sitting in front of TV, he says, says here that by the age of 6 most children have seen 1 million murders on TV. Calvin turns around and he says, I find that very disturbing. It means I've been watching all the wrong channels. Well, you know, it's a joke. You're going to laugh about it. But I've selected that hundreds and hundreds that I've looked at it, because that's full of insight. That is absolutely right. Oh, you sit there and you watch this rubbish. I do. It gives the wrong impression about what sort of behaviour is normal, TV. And that is its greatest danger. It is telling people, and in New Zealand we are turning out a violent society. It tells people that you can kick people and punch them, you can throw them down, you can elbow them out of the way, you can stick knives in them. Because that's what the characters on TV do. I love Saturday morning cartoons, says Calvin. What classic humour. This is what entertainment's all about. Idiots, explosives, and falling anvils. Saturday morning cartoons, you know. And it's right. And they learn from it. Some children, the brighter kids can abstract it and know that it isn't real. But there are a lot of kids who can't tell the difference, and it's showing in society today. Here's another one, the other side of the spectrum, the flip side of the same question. Hey Calvin, you want to play house, says Susie. I don't know how to play, says Calvin. Okay, says Susie, ticking it off on her finger. First, you come home from work, then I come home from work. We'll gripe about our jobs, and then we'll argue about whose turn it is to microwave the dinner. That's what you see on TV, that's the way you live. Right? And this one here, I hope it's not in too poor a taste for this group, but I think you'll understand. Dad, how come you live in this house with Mum instead of in an apartment with several scantily clad female roommates? Said Calvin to his father. And his father sits there with his eyes bulging like this. And then the last one, Calvin's walking away and he says, boy, ask a simple question to get all your TV privileges revoked. But you see it. That is how life is represented on the box. I've got to stop, don't I, Barry? Want to go outside, play outside, says Hobbes. No, he says, I'm watching TV. You hate this show, let's go out. No, he says, why not? Well, Dad finally said he was sick of arguing with me, and for all he cared I could watch TV until my brains oozed out my ears. So you're going to? Yeah, he says, with a hard won privilege. You know, so you're watching in spite of yourself. And so it goes on. I've got a lot more. A few more, anyway. TV in our house has been a bit of a thing. There have been three stages, as I remember it. My father gave us a black and white television when colour television came to New Zealand. I said to him, well, look, my father is not in the truth. I said to him, look, really, we are happier without it. He said, look, there's lots of educational programs. You know, it's good for the kids. He said, well, on the condition that when it breaks down, we won't fix it. We'll put it in a car and we'll dump it. We'll take it out. We'll trash it. That's fine, he said. That's okay. By the way, he said it's got a service contract which I just renewed. Okay. So we took the service contract and the black and white TV and we stuck it in our lounge and it worked okay. We worked out a regime with the kids. We said, each of you, the three of them at that stage, you may watch one program a week, and if it's we judge it to be suitable, then you may watch that. And we thought, well, okay, one program a day or something. I can't remember exactly how it worked. We thought
they're going to see a fair bit of TV at that, under that regime. But in fact, what happened was they all chose the same subject, so they didn't see a lot of TV, and it was, generally speaking, okay stuff. That was all right. It worked all right for the kids because we controlled it, but who controls us? And what happened was that I found myself sometimes working in the study. I get up and I stretch my legs. I go out there and Coral may be doing the ironing. She's just watching some stuff on TV. And I have to stand there and watch it like this. And after a little while, I'd realise that I'd been standing there for half an hour. I'd pull up a seat and I'd sit down. She'd go off to bed. And then I'd watch the thing until it shut down. Which is nuts. Then it went on, this TV, this black and white TV went on, and finally it broke down. And I remembered the deal that we'd made. Right, good. I knew what the fault was. And I could have fixed it. I could have fixed the fault. No, I'm not going to fix this. Hang on a minute. It's got this service contract. Rush off and look through the drawers, and there's a service contract. And lo and behold, it's got 3 days to run. Well, now, as a matter of principle, since this money has been paid to Tisco, they've got to come and fix this set. So the man comes and fixes, and you know that set, it ran for 10 years without quitting. We threw it away. We bought a colour television after some time, and it had wheels on. We bought it because it had wheels on it. We used to wheel it in and out of the lounge and put it away in a wardrobe in our bedroom, and there's something special on, we're putting it out. But after a little while, it got to be too much of a problem. I mean, we're always cutting the thing in and out, so we just left it there, and before long it took over. So in the end, we pulled the plug on it. We tried to sell it, nobody wanted it. I'm not surprised. We pulled the aerial out of it and we put that away, and we made an arrangement so that we didn't pay a license, and we bought a video camera, and we have a video, and we get videos, some not all of which are suitable. We will hire a video, but at least you've got an element of choice there. And the public library, have some good ones and so on. So we've got a sort of an uneasy truce. Now, the reason why I raised this in relation to the kids is because I agree with Waterson and those Calvin and Hobbes things. That television, by and large, is a bane and a snare. The trouble is, it's so easy and so comfortable and so acceptable to our human spirit. It is designed to be. But there is another one of the Calvin and Hobbes things which I really ought to, I suppose, share with you. I'll tell you the story of it. What happens is that Calvin's father boots him out of the house. He says, "Get outside, get some fresh air. You're not going to spend your life sitting in front of this confounded box. Get out of here." So he boots the kid out, you see, and Hobbes goes out. And he picks up Hobbes and dusts him off, and he says, "Okay, well, that's that, isn't it?" And they wander off down the road together. Next thing, they're knocking on the door. "Hey, Susie, what's on TV?" She said, "Hey, it's great. It's in the commercial break. Come in quick." You know, and so he goes in next door. And that's part of the reason we got TV. Well, I mean, we agreed to it. Because, you see, our kids were disappearing next door. We didn't know where they were, but they were going to a Christadelphian family next door, and they were watching TV until their brains oozed out their ears, you know, virtually. And we didn't know what they were watching. Different families, different standards. And so we thought that if you can't beat them, you better join them. And it was a compromise. It's hard to tell 25 years afterwards. There's swings and roundabouts about this. Our kids grew up with a laid-back attitude towards TV. They can take it or leave it. Other families who have put an outright ban on a thing have produced kids who, they're driving down the street and they see a TV in a shop and they're looking at this. You know, they can't get away from it. And it becomes an obsession, you see. So I don't know where the balance is. It's impossible to tell 25 years after if you make the right decisions or the wrong decisions. But I will say this, that none of our kids, television never became an issue for them because it was there. And I'll tell you something else, they're not going to get away from it. It's going to be in the schools. And there is stuff shown in the school where I taught that I wouldn't show to anybody. Chainsaw massacres and stuff like that. I mean, you wouldn't believe the trash that gets shown sometimes in schools. Oh, you dress it up. It's an English lesson. will show this segment, you see, and there's all this kind of stuff, and now let's discuss it. Now, it won't be in all schools, and I hope that it's not in South African schools, but I promise you it's in schools in New Zealand because I've seen it with my own eyes. And so they'll see it. So there is some point in maybe regulating. Perhaps I've gone on too long. I will stop. Question of discipline will be something which we'll have to do in private discussion. Thanks for your patience.